When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode 149. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am staying in God's own country of Wales and heading down to beautiful Abergavenny in Monmouthshire to talk to a pig farmer, Martha Roberts. Martha, how are you?
I'm good, Will. How are you?
Very, very well. We've just been comparing weather notes, haven't we? I'm recording this at the height of August, but it might as well be... I don't know. It's like sort of tropical feeling in Wales at the moment, isn't it? Very hot and humid.
Which is not a word you normally associate with Wales, isn't it? Tropical. We live in tropical Wales.
You never know in a few years' time, global warming. Is it good for pigs though, this weather?
It's all right. I mean, I think if it's like this for months and months on end, like it was last winter, not so much, because the ground gets really treacherous, because they do cause huge damage to ground, pigs do, in when they're in paddocks for a while. But they don't mind the rain at all. The native breeds are big thick coats, so they're fine with that, and they're much, much happier in this weather than they were in last week's weather, when it was time 28 29 30 degrees, where they really struggle. They really get very hot and bothered, very heat stressed. It's quite dangerous for pigs, that kind of weather.
Yeah,
so it's a lot harder work for me in that weather. Actually, it's always hard work for me, but in this weather they just, you know, come out, have breakfast, have a chat to each other and go back to their arcs and have a duvet day, which, frankly,
who wouldn't give them a choice? Can't blame them at all. So you're based in a very beautiful rural part of Wales now, but you actually grew up in industrial city in the north of England, full Monty country, Sheffield.
I did. Yes, I was born in Newcastle upon Tyne, but I was only there a couple of months, and then my parents moved to Sheffield for work. And my dad was working at the university there, and my mum was a teacher, and so I spent the first 18 years of my life in Sheffield. Me and my sister, who's 3 years younger than me, and a very ordinary upbringing in suburban Sheffield. Sheffield's actually quite a green city. You wouldn't think it, but it has lots of parks.
It is,
and it's very close to the Peak District. About as far away from rural farm world as it could possibly be, and you know, an outer city comprehensive school and those sort of things. So yes, it was. It's strange. I go back every now and then because I've got lots of friends there and my family are still there. And it, considering I spent, you know, a good chunk of my life there, I don't feel any huge connection to it, other than the fact that I have obviously still got quite a strong Yorkshire accent. And when I go home, it gets even stronger.
Oh, but, well, that's always the way, isn't it? If you're going to grow up in a city, Sheffield's a cool city to grow up in, though, isn't it? I really like Sheffield. I think it's, you know, it's got a great music scene, and there's a lot going on there, isn't there?
Yeah, and I was there in the early 90s. I was coming of age in the early 90s, where it was kind of super clubs and dance music and all of that sort of stuff, and I have a vague recollection of that era.
Yes. your parents both being academics, was it a very sort of academic household?
Not hugely. They were always of the view that we had to, you know, work hard, but they weren't sort of pushy parents by any stretch of the imagination. My dad was taught English and drama, so there was lots of theatre stuff going on. Not with us involved in it, but he was involved in lots of theatre, Crucible Theatre in Sheffield.
Wow!
So I have memories of childcare sometimes consisting of me being on the stage in the Crucible during rehearsals for things, and that sort of thing. But and lots of quite, as I would have seen it at the time, quite eccentric people chatting and smoking and discussing the issues of the day type of thing. I didn't rebel against kind of academia particularly, but nor was I particularly interested in it, I guess. I did all right. I was reasonably bright. I got through school okay. But I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a driven individual, and my parents weren't there going, you must become a doctor or something like that. They kind of let us both find our own way, really.
Yeah, okay. But your mum's Welsh though, right? So did you visit Wales much growing up?
Well, yes, and that's kind of the reason I'm here. So my mum grew up in Gilwyn, just outside Abergavenny. I'm sitting in a room now, which is probably about 4 miles from where she grew up. She moved away and went to university when she was quite young as well. Because of us living in Sheffield and both my sets of grandparents living quite a long way from us, we would spend our holidays on the road, essentially, divvying up time between grandparents.
Yeah.
And I used to love to come here. I used to love to come to Abergavenny, which is where my grandparents had a farm. So I'm on the same farm as my grandparents had. I basically used to beg every holiday for my mum to drop me off. I didn't want her to stay. I just wanted to drop me off at the farm, leave me there, and come back at the end of the 6 weeks holidays. And that's what they did in some instances, because I was so at home here and so much in love with the outdoor space. And I kind of didn't really think about it as being that at the time. But and it was such a contrast to my normal, in inverted commas, life. But yeah, my grandfather was a massive influence on me. He was the main kind of farmer. And I would have literally moved in with him had that been allowed by social media. But yeah, I loved everything about being here. And I loved the landscape and I loved the feeling of the place. And Abergavenny's an old market town, and in those days had a livestock market. Mm-hmm. And I just loved being here. I found it exciting and kind of freeing, I guess. Big open spaces, big open skies, and I absolutely loved it. So that was a very big part of my how I ended up back here, albeit with a big hiatus in the middle.
Tell us about the hiatus. You worked for Royal Mail, got started there quite early in life.
So I think, like loads of people, I didn't have a plan. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I think that there's a whole load of pressure applied to youngsters now, and even adults for that matter, that says, you must have a plan. What do you want to do with your life? And all this sort of thing. I don't know how you can possibly know what you want to do with your life when you're 16, 17, really, unless you're kind of very vocationally driven and you've always known. But I think loads of people don't know.
Yeah.
And I also think loads of people think they might know and then change their mind 2 or 3 years later. Mm-hmm. But I genuinely didn't know. And I went to university. I worked in a commercial kitchen for a few years, actually, and did a commis chef kind of role and really enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of thought, well, I really should go to university. But it really was a kind of a reluctant decision, really, born out of an absence of a plan. So I went to Hull University because I wanted to stay in the north. Didn't want to go to any one of those fancy universities. And I did a degree in American studies, which was basically American politics and literature, because it gave me a year in America. And I was particularly interested in America because my grandfather was an American. So I decided that would be a jolly good fun thing to do. So I did a 4-year degree, third year in America, spent my time in Albuquerque in New Mexico, then up in Detroit. Then up in Detroit and then over in Seattle. And my aunt was out there at the time working for Ford Motor Company. And so I did the university bit, and then I stayed on for 6 months staying with her and just kind of drinking in the atmosphere, so to speak, and drinking in other things as well, probably. And then I finished. Yeah, I mean, a proper eye-opener. New Mexico in particular, amazing, beautiful place. First time in my life I'd ever been in a position where I was a minority. Which was a proper eye-opener culturally. Food was amazing and all those kind of things. I mean, I always say it's probably the most I've ever learned in the shortest space of time. It was a kind of crash course in all kinds of things you weren't expecting.
I'm a bit of an American history nerd as well. What was the favorite thing that you studied during your degree?
I liked kind of the modern stuff. I mean, I was really lax, to be honest, Will. I studied the things I liked to study and ignored everything else. I was really lazy. Yeah. But I particularly loved, and this was kind of in the mid-1990s I was studying, so I particularly loved the Kennedys and Lyndon Johnson and all of the kind of the post-war period. I was fascinated by that and the civil rights movement. and all of the kind of probably sort of 40s through to 80s, and then Reaganomics and Reagan. I was really interested in how Reagan became president and and how he was kind of, you know, the different people's views of whether Reagan was clever or not, or savvy, all those kind of things. So yeah, that, the political side of it was much more of interest than the literature side, and yeah, the kind of more recent history was the thing that I enjoyed learning about.
Fantastic. It's interesting you say about people not having a plan, because I mean, I'm a bit the same myself. I feel like there's a lot of variables in my life that stop me from having a big plan. But a lot of people say that now, don't they? You say you should write down your goals and have a 10-year, 20-year, 30-year plan. And some people just aren't cut out for that. And I put myself in that because I feel like it, you know, you can put too much pressure on yourself, I think, can't you?
Yeah. But I also think it assumes you go in a kind of straight line from A to Z, where actually I don't think you do. I think you, circumstances or your changes in you mean that you don't go in a straight line from one place to another. And if somebody had told 20-year-old me that 45-year-old me would be standing in the middle of a field on a Tuesday morning surrounded by pigs, I frankly would have laughed them out of the room. And I was with a bunch of university students. A friend of mine's a university lecturer, and she asked me to do a bit of a chat with them. They were inviting lots of different people from lots of different places to talk to youngsters who were about to leave university. And the common feature of all of them were that all of them panicking about making the wrong decision. And I said, well, what are you worried about, that if you make the wrong decision that you know your life is over, that you know it's irreversible? They said, well, we have to have a plan. And I said, well, how about you think about what your next step is? And your next step might be a sideways step, or it might be a thing that you try on for size and then you realize you don't like it so much, and you can then go in a different direction, because long gone are the days where you have to stay in the same industry all your life, and in fact often you can't. So I think I've always been somebody who railed against the idea of being boxed into a category or boxed into something that says Martha is this, or because I think we're all lots of things, and circumstances what usually stops us being more things, I think.
I totally agree, and I actually spoke to students at Harper Adams a few years ago about podcasts and different things, And I said a similar thing to them. I said a lot of you, I can't remember my exact words, but I said a lot of you will be, some of you in the room will be sitting here looking around thinking everyone else has a plan apart from me.
Yes.
and don't let that hold you back. It's okay to feel like that. And there's the Baz Luhrmann
song. Normal.
Yeah, it is. And there's the Baz Luhrmann song, isn't there? Everyone wears sunscreen or whatever it is. And it says some of the most interesting people in my life don't have a plan, age 70. No. So, and I think that's okay. If you can have one, great, but you don't have to, I suppose. But
also, plans can constrain you, because they can stop you doing things you might want to do, but they don't fit with the plan. I also think that plans are tricky, because if you put something down that you want to do and you're somebody who's not very good at managing failure or dealing with failure, then what if your plan doesn't work out? How do you deal with the fact that you pinned everything on this plan? So I think, fine, have a plan, but have some flex in it that says if it doesn't work out, I'll do something differently.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. So tell us about the first stage of working at Royal Mail before we get to the big change.
Well, so it was a bit of an probably shouldn't say it, but so I came out of university and I didn't have a plan, as we've established.
Yeah,
And so I thought, well, I'll just have to apply for the kind of the regular graduate training schemes. And we're back in an era here in 1998 where there were a lot of graduate training schemes. They were all okay paid. Mm-hmm. You went through rounds of interviews and things like to get through them. And I applied for a whole bunch of them. And I got down to some. I got down to the last few. Some I didn't get anywhere at all. I got offers from Majestic Wine Warehouses. In retrospect, that would have been a very nice job. and Royal Mail.
Yeah.
And the reason I chose Royal Mail was because I wanted to stay in the north. And they said, they gave me the option of where I'd like to go. And in a complete lack of sort of thought or forethought, I said, well, I quite fancy Liverpool.
Okay.
I had no idea that going to Liverpool Royal Mail was effectively like saying you were going to the Union H quarters of Royal Mail, and that it was probably the most politically sensitive area that the company had geographically.
Okay.
Didn't know any of that.
Right.
And so I arrived as a trainee operational manager, which it turned out was kind of like crowd control.
Okay.
So you're working in a kind of a busy depot or a delivery office. And there's 80 fellas in you, and you're 24 or 23 or whatever I was. And there's a lot of shouting and a lot of arguing about what radio station people should be allowed to listen to, because the older fellas want Radio 2 on and the younger fellas want Kiss FM.
Yeah.
So you spend a lot of time shouting and generally chivying them along. But it was about the best schooling in people and understanding people I've ever had. It was slightly painful because delivery offices in those days, you had to get up at 4 a.m.
Oh, my.
I really wasn't very good at that. Reasons why I'm not a dairy farmer. So there was an awful lot, but there was an awful lot of, as you might imagine, in a Liverpudlian delivery office, quite a lot of jokes and banter and hijinks. And I probably learned to be as sarcastic as I am whilst doing those jobs. And we had lots of strikes because in the company in those times there was a lot of that going on, a lot of industrial relations issues, which was symptomatic of what was going on in broader industry. And it was an absolute schooling in people and how to manage people or how not to manage people in lots of cases, because the idea that I was called a manager was frankly hilarious to me, because I didn't know how to manage my way out of a paper bag at that stage. So I did a variety of those kind of operational roles, working in the big mail center factories, environments very male dominated, but curiously quite good fun, because they weren't used to having a female manager. I didn't, of course, know that when I went in there. It hadn't occurred to me that might be the case, but they didn't really know how to behave with you, other than they were worried about what their mothers might think. So you could kind of get things done in a way that the male counterparts couldn't, because
That's interesting.
They would just give back to the male managers, whereas with me they'd be worried about offending me, which afforded me lots of opportunity to get things done. But it was tough. I mean, it was a tough environment, and I did that for probably about 5 years, working shifts. And then I moved into various different project-y type roles. And then I shifted into the customer service part of Royal Mail, which is huge, as you might imagine, with an organisation like that. So worked my way up through the ranks there, was head of their kind of communications and engagement and people support and all that sort of stuff. Done a stint in international logistics, which sounds really glamorous, but is basically sheds and trucks in other countries. not so glamorous at all.
No.
And then I've been in the sales function for the last 2 years, again, doing a similar kind of people support role, those kind of things. So I used to be very office-based. For the last few years, I've been much more remotely based, just travelling around to various different things, and obviously not travelling at all in the last 6 months or so.
No. So you obviously enjoy working with people then, and being sort of in a busy environment. So so how did you get to be on a hill farm in Monmouthshire? Where there are not many people around.
No, there really aren't. So I think I loved my job for a very long time, and it was my main focus in life.
Yeah.
And most of my life was tied up with how I felt about myself at work and those sort of things. And I think that was all fine. And I'd moved around the country because the job had sort of allowed me to do that. And I wasn't against the idea of moving around the country, and I quite liked that.
Mm-hmm.
But then in kind of 2010, 11, so I was in my mid 30s by that stage, I just started to get these kind of niggling feelings, and I couldn't pinpoint where they'd come from. And bearing in mind that during this period, I hadn't spent much time out in my grandparents' place. You know, I'd been doing the kind of the young person climbing the ladder thing.
Yeah.
And I just started to get a very sort of niggling feeling. A relationship I was in that was a long-term relationship was coming to an end. And I was really sure that I didn't want children. And that prompted a whole kind of thought process about, is my job who I am, or is there more to me than that? And my job had also got to the stage where I was questioning whether actually I whether I was just going to do the same thing for the next 20 years or so, and whether I was okay with that. And it wasn't that I disliked it. I just thought, actually, if I fell over tomorrow, it was a conversation with a friend that prompted it, where I said, if I fell over tomorrow, as in dead, would I be all right with the fact that on my tombstone it'd say Martha Royal Mail letters did that stuff? And I thought, God, that's really dull. Seriously, Martha, try better. And that set off a kind of almost a chain reaction that I couldn't really control, which was me thinking, well, if I'd wanted to do something else, what else would I do? So I started to do bits of stuff like, I was always a reasonably competent cook, but I got really interested in cooking, and I went on a course in Ashburton Cookery School in Devon, because I thought, well, actually, maybe I want to go back into the restaurant business. And so I did a classics cookery course, and the course was 5 days long, and it was a really good course. But on day four, they brought in the producers of the food that we were cooking.
Okay.
And it was on reflection at the end of day four, I thought, no, that's the thing I'm interested in. Yeah. I'm interested in who makes this stuff and who produces this stuff and where it comes from. And found myself bending the ear of the cattle farmer who had come in and things like that. And I thought, well, that's peculiar. I hadn't really thought about that before.
That's really good that they do that on that course, isn't it? That's really interesting, I think.
Yeah. I mean, they're in a kind of a really kind of producer rich sort of environment. And so, yeah, they would bring in kind of people who they use the produce of. And then and that kind of made me think a bit. And then I started deciding that I was really interested in butchery. This concerned my parents greatly, because midlife crisis plus knives equals potential disaster. So I went on a number of butchery courses and loved it. And then I started thinking, oh, okay, well, maybe that's something as well. So I was just kind of collecting information as I was going along, really, in an informal way. Not in a planned way. Mm. And then I randomly booked myself onto a 1 day pig keeping course, just, you know, because I could, down in Salisbury Plain with a guy called Tony York, who's no longer with us, but he used to run this little place called Pig Paradise, which was essentially training pig keepers or giving people the opportunity to spend a day with pigs. And I spent a day there and thought, I could do this. And I don't know what on earth made me think that, other than I just thought, I'm really comfortable around these animals. This is, and I was thinking, well, if I had a few pigs, then I could get better at butchery and that kind of thing. But it wasn't a business plan at all. It was more a kind of a life, oh, maybe this self-sufficiency lark thing, I could have a go at some more of that.
Yeah.
Kind of having watched The Good Life in my childhood. Fast forward about probably a year, when I'd moved out of my place that I was living in the Cotswolds at that point in time. I'd spent a few months back home with mum and dad whilst all my stuff was in storage. And I thought, well, and my grandfather had quite advanced dementia, and they'd sort of stopped farming. They were letting the farm out mainly to sheep farmers.
Okay.
But there was a self-contained parcel of land, and I hatched a plan and said to my uncle, who lives on site there but isn't a farmer, well, what if I could buy or rent some land, because I'd like to grow some stuff and just have a play about with some things. And for whatever mad reason, they said, all right then. But my plan was to grow some veg, have a few porkers, you know, have a very pretty kind of setup. Yeah. Everything looks very organized.
Yeah.
And I would be there in my dungarees looking fabulous and eating my own homegrown food and all of that sort of stuff. And so I moved here in the winter of 2012, rented a cottage nearby, and that was a really bad winter, actually. It had that incredibly cold snap in January 2013. So I was pretty much confined to barracks, because I lived on the top of a hill and I had a mini at the time, for about a week and a half. And in that time, I started following James Rebanks on Twitter and Gareth Wynne Jones on Twitter. Yeah. And it was the year that Gareth was pulling sheep out of the snow. The weather was bad. Yeah. And I was already involved in Twitter anyway, because my work, my corporate job, I used it for that. And I started following farmers and those sort of things. And the whole thing just sort of literally snowballed. So yeah, I had a lovely, I had a beautiful veg garden in 2013. Amazing, kind of half an acre of beautifully crafted vegetables. Yeah. And I was so proud of it. Never since has it looked like that. And then I got three wieners. And I've not been without pigs since.
I'm really interested in something you said to me before the interview. I wanted to have something to show for my efforts, produce something, create something tangible. Yes. I think that's something that perhaps a lot of us in farming don't maybe think about enough, that we take for granted a little bit that we do that. And I perhaps don't think about that enough myself as well, because a lot of people I think want to feel like that, don't they? And
And I didn't know that I wanted to feel that until a bunch of other things were happening in my life, and it felt like it felt like I didn't have an anchor. So the beauty of me being single and at the time and not financially in a reasonably good position and not having a house to sell or anything like that, you would think that would afford kind of brilliant, huge freedom to do whatever you want, be wherever you want, that kind of thing. And it does to a certain extent, but it also makes you feel like you're without anchor. So you haven't got anything to cling to. So you're starting again. And that felt very risky, I guess. Yeah. If you work in the corporate world, everything is about avoiding risk. But actually, I remember thinking, it doesn't matter where I am, and that feels and that feels really uncomfortable. Mm. And so I started thinking quite a lot about the fact that my industry is a service industry mainly, and most of my time production would be classed as, you know, achieving a better process or supporting people. Which you can say is worthy and useful, but I couldn't say I built that or I produced that, or that was me. And I felt really strongly that I needed something like that to demonstrate that I could build something, I could, I could be responsible for something. And again, it wasn't a grand plan to build a business or anything like that particularly. It was more to demonstrate to myself that I could do more than I currently did. Because I've never worried that much about what other people think. I'm far more worried about what I think of me, and I'm very we are all harsh critics of ourselves, I think, but yeah, I just thought, actually, could I be something different? And the fact that I was, you know, single and was kind of moving to a bit of the country that nobody could see if I really screwed up was quite attractive, really. Because I thought, well, actually, worst case scenario, it all goes horribly wrong. I absolutely hate it. And I'll do, you know, I'll just kind of stop.
Yeah.
I had that luxury.
So moving particularly to Abergavenny, somewhere that you spent so much time with as a child, did that sort of... as someone who had moved around a lot, and you said you didn't really feel the connection to Sheffield when you go home now, did that feel somehow like sort of coming home in a way?
Yeah, and it was really hard to describe or explain. But when I was doing the whole I don't feel anchored to anywhere thing, I was trying to think of where had I lived or been that I felt connected to, because connection suddenly became quite an important thing, and the only place that I could come up with was here, and I was trying not to rose tint it. I was trying to think, well, actually, do I think that because that's where I spent so much time as a child, being super happy, and I therefore got massive, you know, massively rosy glow of stuff about it. But then I thought, well, actually, you know, if I rent a place and it all doesn't go wrong, I can move again, because that's what I've done for 20 years. But it was very much a kind of a gut feeling, more than anything else. But it's one that has paid off enormously, because every time I come back here when I've been away, I round the bend, see Raglan Castle, see the big open skies and the Sugarloaf Mountain, and my heart soars. I have a connection I can't quite describe adequately to the landscape and to the the way it feels to be here. And it is very landscape driven, actually, I think, more than it is people driven.
Yeah.
There's a sense of place that I, and connection to place that I feel here, that I can't really understand, but I love it.
Well, there is a word in Welsh, of course, that describes that, isn't there? Hiriaeth, that longing for home or a place that might not even exist, but only in your own imagination. But it's a wonderful word, isn't it?
So yeah, it is. It's brilliant. Yeah.
Seems to work in this.
It does. Yeah.
So tell us about your grandfather, because he sounds like quite a guy.
Yeah, I mean, he was an amazing man, really. He was called Bob Rivers. Robert Patton Rivers was his name.
Wow, okay.
And he was born in Georgia, in Atlanta, in 1924. And he was born into a family who were beyond poor. So both his parents were what was known in those days, although they wouldn't be known as that now, as deaf and dumb. So they couldn't speak and they couldn't hear. And so the job opportunities for them were very limited. Mm-hmm. So they were, as he described it, dirt poor. Mm. And therefore, he didn't have a lot of formal schooling. And his elder sister, Estelle, who was about 7 or 8 years older than him, was his primary carer while his parents worked numerous menial jobs.
Yeah.
And he worked from a really young age. I've got a picture of him when he's about 9 with a little cart where he's going around doing deliveries for people. And they moved more times than he can remember, because they were always trying to avoid the rent.
Yes.
And so he was born, so by the time he was 5, America was in its Great Depression.
Of course, yeah.
So it was, you know, about as different a world as I can ever imagine, really. And age 16, him and his best mate Joe Perriello joined the American Army, and they joined the American Army because they wanted to travel the world, get fed, and get girls. and both of them achieved that.
I was going to say, and of course, that all worked. those fabulous American World War II uniforms, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he still had his military briefcase and his traveling trunk and all of that sort of stuff that was all in the farmhouse, along with his Confederate flag, which in those days was slightly less contentious than it is now. So he came over here. He was more of an administrator than a frontline fighter, and he used to run the administration side of field hospitals, mm-hmm. and organise all the doctors' diaries and those sort of things. So he came over here when he was 18, and he was stationed. There was a huge American Army base in Gilwan, just outside Abergavenny.
Okay.
And 8,000 American troops descended on this area.
8,000.
Which you can kind of only imagine the absolute. Yeah. I mean, my grandmother describes it as she said, "I know the war was a bad thing, Martha." She died a couple of years ago. But she said, "I know the war was a bad thing, Martha, but it was terribly fun, because from her perspective,
yeah,
a small Welsh town was consumed by lots of glamorous Americans, and they brought with them kind of donut shacks and all of the, and they had dances, and there was lots of infrastructure that grew up around the American Army being here." So yes, those two met met young, and then he went off over to Belgium and worked his way up through into Germany after the war, and was there as the Russians were leaving. Mm-hmm. And had lots of things that towards the back end of his life he started to talk a bit about what he'd never talked about before and what he saw. Mm-hmm. But after the war, when he was demobbed, they had my eldest uncle, who was born in America, because the tradition was you got married and as a GI bride you went back to America.
Yeah.
But my grandmother being, how should we put this, a reasonably classic Welsh matriarch, went to America, decided it wasn't for her, and said, "I'm going home, you can either come or not." And he did. He followed her back here.
That's amazing. Fantastic.
She was kind of 4'10" of dynamite, my grandmother.
Yeah.
So they came back. They had 2 more children, and they stayed here. And my grandfather, at first, he he got an IT qualification and went to work at ICI and worked at ICI for many years. Okay. And then as he was older, and just as I was born, actually, he decided they'd inherited a farmhouse from my grandmother's family, who all of whom farmed in this area, and all bar her father were farmers until they died, farmers, butchers, until they died. Her father had got out, in inverted commas, as he would describe it, and started his own little bus company and done quite well for himself. But yeah, so my grandfather then went to agricultural college, and then they had a small beef and Welsh mountain sheep farm all through my years up until they stopped when I was about, probably when I was about 30, they stopped. So about 30 years they did it.
Fantastic. Yeah. That's such a cool family history to have, isn't it?
He was a cool man. He was, you know, a good-looking, wise-cracking prankster of a man. And I literally loved the bones of him. I would follow him around constantly. And how he put up with me, I have no idea. I wanted to be wherever he was. And I was fascinated by him and fascinated by everything he did. And we would go to the livestock market together on a Tuesday morning, and he would stand me up on the rails watching the animals go around the ring, and then he would park me in the Angel Hotel pub whilst with Pop and Chris while him and his mates did their chat. Classic kind of farmer gathering stuff. And I loved everything about him and the life we had together.
I mean, it's no wonder that it felt like coming home to you, I guess, in a way, then going back to the farm. So, I mean, tell us about the early days when you first sort of moved there. You decided you were going to move, and you arrived there, and you had all these great ideas. How did it go in those sort of first few months? I mean, did you? I know you said you'd done the course on pig keeping. Did you feel like you were very much sort of in the deep end? I guess you did.
Well, I think the thing is you can read all this stuff.
Yeah.
and then there's reality. So, I mean, I went to get my first three wieners, and I went over to Llandilo because a friend of mine who was mainly a goat farmer actually had some wieners, some crossbreed wieners. So I took a trailer over there, first time I'd ever driven a trailer. Got lost because, you know, that's what you do.
Because we're Welsh.
And then I had to do like a 56-point turn in a poor Welsh farmer's yard with him trying to be not quite baffled about how this person had ended up in his yard with a trailer that she couldn't drive. And the rain was kind of like today. It was biblical. One of the pigs escaped as we were trying to load it into the trailer. It was total carnage. And then I drove back. And I parked up to let them back into this beautifully constructed pen that I'd made for them. And I sat there for about half an hour before I let them out of the trailer because I was so terrified I was going to, you know, kill them within seconds. Actually, they were perfect start pigs. They really behaved themselves. They lulled me totally into a false sense of security because I've never had pigs that behaved so well ever since. So I had them from kind of May through until the end of October, and I loved having them there. They're such interesting animals to be around, and such fun as well. And that meant, of course, that when came time to take them to the abattoir, which in itself, doing that for the first time is pretty stressful.
If
you've got an abattoir where it requires you to do a full kind of 90-degree right hand reverse around a bend routine to get to the drop off gate.
Yeah,
I had some very, very patient men at the abattoir who offered to do it for me in a very kind and non-patronising way. the run-up to that, I found that really hard. It weighed very heavy on me, and because it was the first time I'd ever done it, and I was doing it on my own. But when they'd gone, I had an empty field, and I thought, I really miss them. I really miss having them around. So for all of the wrong reasons, and again, without a plan, I got some more. And the next lot I got were an absolute horror show.
Were they? So how did you decide what breed to go for?
Well, so in the early days, I wasn't hugely picky because my strategy, as much as there was one, was to try and learn about keeping pigs. And so most of the first ones were Welsh crosses. They had a bit of Petrain in them as well, so they weren't rare breeds. Mm-hmm. Those are the first three, and then the second lot I got were pure Mangalitzers, who are furry, hairy pigs.
Yeah,
bonkers. They're bonkers.
There's a reason they're rare, is it?
Oh my goodness. Right. Well, yeah. So they, night one, those three escaped.
Okay.
Went on a tour of the valley for 10 days. I had to notify everybody because they looked like wild boar and I didn't want the police to shoot them.
Of course,
yeah. And after about 10 days of many, many sightings, but not actually finding them, I gave up and I thought, well, I'm just going to have to chalk this one up to experience and being a twit and not having had a secure pen for them. And so I went to pick up three more, which were saddleback crosses, slightly less nuts. And as I was driving back up the lane, my late grandmother phoned me and said, Arthur, Chris, who's the next door sheep farmer, has found your piglets.
Okay.
I said, has he? Okay. And he said, yeah, he's they've eaten three of his ducklings and they're snoring in his haystack. Can you go and pick him up?
Okay.
Oh, God almighty, I'm going to be in deep trouble here. So, yes.
That's awkward.
My neighbour was repaid heavily in bacon for his silence. But, yeah, so then I had six that I was rearing on at that stage. But in terms of how I started, I was interested in rare breeds from the start. I was interested initially in Oxford Sandy and Blacks just because I liked the look of them. And they were a good dual purpose pig. And but then I got offered by a really good Gloucester Old Spot breeder, a gilt who was in pig. And I thought, well, that's an easy way in. Mm-hmm. I'll do that. And I have loved Gloucester Old Spots ever since. They are delightful. They're placid and gentle and amazing mothers. You don't really tend to have many farrowing difficulties with them. Mm-hmm. They're really lovely, and because they're lop-eared pigs, they don't tear around like lunatics like some of the others do when they're larger, so they're really manageable. But yeah, Gloucester Old Spots are my great love. They're kind of like a kid's picture book pig.
Yeah,
they're sort of classic. Kids see them and they go, oh, because they look like pigs in picture books.
Yes, well, my second daughter, my 8-year-old, is very keen to get some pigs, and I actually showed her some of the videos on your Twitter feed, and I think I think I've done it now. I think that's it now. I think she's set her heart on some Gloucester Old Spots, so I might be giving you a shout at some point.
They're lovely animals.
Yeah, it looks like they'd be good ones for kids. Yeah, they look, you know, good.
Yeah, well, yeah,
to learn on. You know, not too.
And pigs generally are very, if they've been handled from when they're little, they're very sociable. They're very comfortable around people. They're very interested in people, unlike quite a lot of farm animals. So they're never indifferent to you being there.
No.
Which can be fabulous fun. Also, it means you can't get any jobs done in their paddocks when they're awake, because they will come and watch or get involved or pick up the fencing reel that you're trying to meticulously keep in a sensible way and run off with it and things like that. They are helpful.
so tell us about the system there, because they're obviously all outdoors and free range. Tell us how it all works.
Well, so yeah, I'm fully free range, not organic, but free range. I never thought about doing anything other than free range. Mm-hmm. I think once you've seen, and I know that some people will disagree with me on this, but I think once you've seen pigs outside and seen how much time they spend rooting around in the ground and with their snouts in the soil, and when you've seen piglets who come out of their arc with their mum for the first time and they're 2 days old and the first thing they do is put their snout to the soil and start nosing around in it, the idea that you don't allow them to do that I can't fathom doing that, or I couldn't run a system that did that.
So
when we're all outside, I have a couple of maternity sheds that I use, usually if I've got youngsters who I don't know how they haven't farrowed before, and where I've got electric and lighting, and in the event anything goes wrong, I can get a vet to them, etc. But often the older sows will farrow out in big farrowing arcs out in the fields and do so without any issue at all. So yes, they're on pasture, although it's a bit muddy at the moment, even in August. And I also have about 3 acres of old oak and beech woodland.
Okay.
Which is on quite a steep camber. But I have lots of my animals up in there because they are at their most comfortable in woodland. Woodland, yes. They absolutely love it. And in the autumn where you've got beech mast and acorns coming down, they are very happy. They're kind of Welsh Iberico pigs, I would like to say, in munching their acorns.
That's a good way of adding value.
Isn't it just? Yeah, although they do get to the stage where they eat so many acorns, you can virtually hear them rattling.
Yes, I can well imagine that's the case. Yeah,
but yes, free range and outdoor, and outdoors in all weather. And if you have native breeds, they grow big, thick coats in winter, so they're fine in terribly cold temperatures. So when we had the beast from the east thing a couple of years ago, the pigs were fine, as long as I could stop, and I always sight the arcs away from the prevailing wind.
Yeah.
As long as you can keep them in an arc that's dry and as draft-free as possible, then they're fine in cold weather. In fact, they're better in that kind of weather than they are in the extreme heat. Mm. But they're very happy. They have a siesta in the middle of the day. Pigs generally they're very civilized animals. I mean, the disadvantage of that, of course, is that they carve up your pasture. Of course they do. Yeah. My land is all very rough grazing. It's not. It couldn't be used for anything else. It can't, and the camber of it means it can't even be used for haymaking. Yeah, you do have to manage the paddocks. And last year that was an absolute battle that I'm still dealing with the aftermath of now.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're also fortunate to have a local abattoir. We've got one not too far from here as well. But I mean, it is a big problem in the UK, isn't it? Small local abattoirs closing, and it is having a big impact on our food system, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is that if you don't have local network of suppliers and things like abattoirs, then I couldn't operate. No. It's as simple as that. If my local abattoir shut, heaven forbid, you know, in 3 months' time, I would be snookered. Mm. Because my abattoir is 15 minutes from me. It means that I can, you know, roll out of bed, walk the pigs into the trailer, and within 20 minutes I'm there. And it's a low throughput abattoir. So it's just sheep and pigs they do there. and they know me, and I know the setup, and they are not in a huge rush, and therefore you have confidence in what they do and how they do it and the care of your animals, because if you spend your whole life caring for them, you definitely care about how that bit works as well. And they're much more likely to manage stunned slaughter as opposed to gassing pigs, which I'm really not in favor of at all. So they're really important. And I have them, and then I have a local butcher as well who does all of the packing, weighing. So he bears all of the brunt of the food standards, guidelines and qualification for packing and vac packing and all that kind of thing. He also makes my meat look great and presentable, which I couldn't do because I'm not a master butcher. So without those two bits of the chain, my little business wouldn't work at all. So I forever live in fear of what happens if. It's really important. And if people are interested in local food chains, it's not just about having local farmers. It's about having the local utilities to be able to support that. Pete Mawson recently up in North Yorkshire has had to stop with pigs because he doesn't have a butcher.
Yeah,
that's really bad, isn't it?
It is. It is. It is really bad. I mean, it feels like there's a lot of talk about it at the moment, even right up to sort of government level, but it doesn't feel like much is being done about it. Because as you say, Pete's such a good example of someone who's successfully outdoor pigs and he's had to stop doing it. And it's so sad. And it's not only sad for him, it's sad for his community and everybody who buys locally produced high welfare meat from him, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and it's not like there's a lack of demand for it, actually. I started 5 or 6 years ago, all of the guidance that I got from people was make sure you've got demand, make sure you find demand, don't send pigs off without knowing how, you know, that it's all sold. And it was all about finding demand, because finding demand was difficult then in those days. Now, particularly recently, demand's coming out of our ears, frankly, which is fabulous, but it relies on you having an infrastructure there to support those kind of small businesses. And so, yeah, I think it's the reason why it's not just important. If you want to change the way people buy things, it's not just important to educate, which I think is a really patronising word, consumers.
Yes.
It's also government. Government, yeah, and infrastructure is required to enable those local businesses to function, I think.
Mm. So how do you sell the meat primarily?
So I sell directly to consumers. So I sell via a website, although it's a very basic website. You've probably seen it, but
what's it called if anyone wants to visit and buy some?
It's called The Decent Company, decentcompany.co.uk.
Okay.
And the website is kind of the showcase for what I do, because what I do is the reason I sell meat. And interestingly, the reason I ended up selling meat in the first place, rather than just kind of producing it for myself and friends and family and things, was because I started to get asked about it. I started using social media just because when I started, I was doing it on my own. It was quite a lonely endeavor.
Mm.
And when I first had piglets, I was so excited and I really didn't have very many people to tell. So I just started posting pictures of them I thought, these cute, this is really cute, and I'm really proud of myself.
I think that's why a lot of farmers use social media, though, isn't it? Because we do like what we do, and we want to just say, look, this is, you know, look at this, isn't it great?
Yeah, exactly. And it started to get kind of a bit of traction. Then I started to get people, not huge numbers of people, but people asking, well, can I buy the meat that you produce? And so then in about 2016, I thought, I really do have to get a bit more organized about this. So I got a website built and I put down the proper relationship with the butcher that I still use now. And the interesting thing, I think, probably is that the way it works is I take my pigs into the abattoir, they then transfer to the butcher. The butcher then operates to a cutting list that I provide him.
Yes.
And then I do what I call meat box Jenga, where I pack it all into the relevant bits that people have ordered, and then I ship it out the door. Either that is local deliveries, which I tend to do, or it goes out to a courier who couriers it around the UK. Okay. A lot of my meat, it doesn't stay local. It goes all over the place. Loads goes up to Scotland, peculiarly. Wow. I'm very grateful to come from Scotland. so it works like that. And I would say that probably towards 70% of everything I sells via Twitter.
Really
not because crazy. I put out a thing on Twitter that says anybody wants to buy anything, but because historically people have found me through Twitter, and then they then order from me as a consequence of that. I have lots of repeat customers, but yeah, a huge proportion of my sales come from my little old Twitter account.
I think sort of one of the good things about what you do is that you obviously post the videos that I've seen that I showed my daughter, the piglets and things like that. But you're also mm-hmm. very honest on there, and you post about when you've had a bad day as well. And I think people do, they respond to that, I think, don't they? I think there's something in that that's quite important, I think.
Well, I think people are always looking for human connections with people, aren't they?
Very much so, yeah.
If you present yourself as having this beautiful, idyllic life,
yes,
then people will look at that and go, isn't that all lovely?
Yeah.
But if you sometimes have a lovely, idyllic life, and then you say, you know what, today has been awful, and here's the reason it's been awful, I think people suddenly go, oh, okay. And it feels real, because it is real. And I think none of us do a service to other humans to pretend.
No.
That any of us have got all this right, and that any of us are living a life that is gorgeous all of the time. And I think people do respond to that because they realize that whilst they might love your life, I get a lot of people saying, I'd love your life. And I always say to them, you love my life in that photo. You wouldn't love my life in winter 2019, love, not for any amount of money. So I think it's important to be honest about those things, because otherwise I would be playing into that kind of hackneyed stereotype of isn't it all cutesy in the wonderful world of small farming. And yeah, sometimes it's like everything, isn't it? You have great days and you have days where you just think, I want to curl up in a ball, cry and never get up again.
So
I kind of think that bit's important, really. And it does seem to garner huge support. I get huge support from people, and I feel it, which is lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, very similar here. I mean, I've talked about it on past podcast episodes, but and on social media. But I had the worst year of my farming career last year. Awful flooding, and it just felt like one thing after another. The pressure of a very wet summer last year, trying to get grain in and things like that. And it did massively. Well, Sarah's at the end of my tether was a bit of an understatement, but I did have a huge positive response from people, mostly people I've never met on Twitter, and it did help me. It did help me know that there's so many people out there who understand and wish you well. I think it was very
kind of virtual solidarity, isn't it? I call it where you feel that people actually care whether you succeed or not, and that they've got your back a bit, really. And you have I had lots of people last year who said, you probably did too, that said, I don't know how you do it. And I always used to smile because I'd say, well, you do it because when you're in it, you've got no choice.
Yeah.
You have to keep going.
Exactly.
And that's the only option. You've got stock relying on you. You've got bills to pay. You've got, you know, you do it because that's the only option at that point in time. I mean, you might get a spring go, I'm done. but the reality is when you're in the middle of it, you have to do it. And I share on Twitter when I lose animals and what I feel about that, because I think that's part of farming. I think that's an important part of farming, because I also think that there is a growing, I think it's growing, notion that farmers don't really care, that it's all about economics, and that somehow we are, you know, just in it for the money. I mean, I would laughably invite anybody who thinks that to come and do farming and think we're just in it for the money, because I don't know about you, Will, but I don't see an awful lot of people raking in.
No,
no, do I. Ways to make a buck.
they really are. You're right. And, you know, you only have to look. I mean, we live in a predominantly dairy farming area here, and a lot of my friends have a lot of problems with TB. You know, I've sat down with some of my best mates across their kitchen table, lads who've been born into farming families, big rough tough sort of lads, and they've had tears rolling down their face because they've lost cows, and you know, I've tried to explain that to people, and it's perhaps difficult to get across, but I do think it's really important that we do that.
It's not a sentimentality, it's a care thing.
Yeah,
that's the difference. It's not a pet thing. It's often a combination of feeling like you've let animals down,
I'd agree. Do you think that sometimes especially small scale farming is painted very romantically sometimes, isn't it? I mean, you hinted at it before, but sometimes, like, you see in a Sunday newspaper magazine article that, you know, you can sell your house in London and move to rural Wales and it will be lovely, and it really isn't like that, is it? And I think, you know, it is important that the likes of yourselves are honest, because, you know, for those people as well, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I think small-scale farming gets painted in two ways, neither of which are accurate particularly.
Yeah.
It's either that it's the good life type thing, and it's all beautiful, long, lush meadows with animals capering around, and you can wear nice-looking country cash clothes.
You can wear sort of £250 wellies and head to toe in Barbara and tweed, and
yeah, and have a picnic blanket ready for, you know, chilled wine at lunchtime and all that kind of thing. Yeah. If only. So I think there's that stereotype, and I think that's a yearning from people to want to think that still exists.
I think it is.
If it ever existed,
No. And
so I think to some extent it's not harmful per se, but as long as people understand that it's not real, and that small farming has its challenges in the same way as large farming does. It might not be as economically risky, but you also, if you're a small farmer, you've got you don't get the economy of scale that you can get with buying and purchasing. You probably can't afford to, or can't justify having the kind of kit that big farmers have either, and also if your land gets in a mess, you don't have anywhere else to move stock to. You haven't got as many options for shifting around and those sort of things. Mm-hmm. So I think that way that it's painted, I try and say small scale farming has its own challenges, and it's not all pretty. And big farming can be pretty too. That's the reality, is that farming can look pretty if you put a lens on anything in a certain way. But I think the other way that it's painted, and I think this comes more from within the farming community itself, is that there is a dismissal of small scale farming by some that says this is irrelevant, this isn't proper farming, this is hobby farming, this is not relevant, this isn't going to feed the world, etc., etc. And I often wonder where that kind of defensiveness, as it feels, and it comes from, because small farms don't threaten big farms.
No,
they don't. So, and why we wouldn't want to have a kind of a spread bet of big farms and small farms, I don't know, actually, because small farms can get going often without the same outlay as big farms. They're often the way in for new entrants. And so I think that there's room for all of us, really.
Yeah,
and
there is.
And I think a blend is good. And I think it's tempting always as a small farmer to, when you get a lot of demand, to go, should I be bigger? Should I get bigger? Because we're almost conditioned to think bigger is better. And I tried to get a bit bigger last year. It was not a good idea. And I lived with a very bad winter and thought, actually, no, my limits are this. I will stick to this. So, yes, I think there is certain respect for me for people who do this on a very big scale, but an acknowledgement that it's a very different operation, but there are room for both, I think.
Yeah, and I think we can all learn from each other in the industry, can't we? Whether you're a huge arable farm or a smaller pig farm like yourself, there's something you can learn, isn't there? And I don't know.
Absolutely.
I don't know what the definition of a farmer is anyway. You know, what is the definition of a farmer? It doesn't mean, say, you have to be farming 5,000 acres, does it? There's no...
Well, no, and you do get the fabulous things where you get people who say, you don't look like a farmer. And I go, don't I?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
What does a farmer look like?
Exactly. Last year, though, something very exciting happened. You managed to buy the old house that's sat in the middle of your land. That must have been a bit of a dream scenario, I would think.
Yeah. So I have about 15 acres of quite rough land and woodland, and in the middle of that sits this white house. And it's not, don't get me wrong, it's not a manor house or anything like that. It's like a Welsh farmhouse that's been extended in the 1980s. So there are some fantastic design features. And when I moved there, a woman had owned it for by that point for about 10 years, and she lived overseas. And she'd always meant to live there, but her circumstances had changed with her husband, and so she never lived there. So it was just kind of sitting there, and I approached her and said, would you be willing to think about selling it? And she said, not at the moment. And I thought, fine, okay. So I would drive around this house, you know, countless times a day, because it sits slap bang in the middle of my land, and think, oh. And so eventually I just sort of stopped thinking about it. But she had guys who would come in and check over it every now and then, who looked after, she had a number of properties, and they would come and stay for a couple of days and do maintenance work and that sort of thing. And I said to them, apart from plying them with bacon and eggs, it has to be said, I had said to them, if Leo ever thinks about selling this, would you let me know? And they said, yes, we will. And then about a year and a half ago, they collared me and said, she's going to sell. And I said, great, do you know what's happening, what the process is? And they said, we're going to suggest to her that she gives you first refusal.
Okay.
So that she doesn't have to put it on the market. Because my big fear was that if it went on the open market, it would spiral to a place that there was no way I could afford, because it has, the position of the house is the best on the entire kind of lane. It has views directly over the Black Mountains and the Sugarloaf. It's a beautiful spot. And I thought, the trouble is that the likelihood is somebody will see it second homer and go, I don't really care what it costs, that's pin money.
Yeah.
And that would be that. And short of having a plan to unleash the pigs and try and put them off, I didn't really have a plan B. So yes, she very, very kindly gave me first refusal on it. And me and my partner Chris bought it. And it, after about 8 months of faffing around and talking about legal boundaries and soakaways and God knows what else. We completed on it last summer. It has no proper drive up to it. So that's an interesting challenge. So we haven't done anything with it yet, other than we're literally about to get planning permission to knock down a very terrible extension and replace it with something that's more in keeping with the farmhouse. And then the work will probably take place early spring next year in reality. It's kind of a long haul project. It's structurally pretty good. But it would be nice to live on site, because not living on site brings its own challenges as well.
That's incredibly exciting, though, for the future, though, isn't it? I mean, do you see yourself, once you've done the house and it's all up, is that you there for life? That's where you're going to live?
Yeah.
See how your days. That's so cool.
I think so, yeah. I can't imagine myself anywhere else, and I've never said that before I lived here.
Yeah.
And the house belonged to my family until 1948, when my great uncles flogged it, allegedly to pay a poker debt. And so I'm joining the house and the land back together slightly better circumstances.
Yeah, that is such a happy ending. I really like that.
Yeah, reprobate uncles, flog it to pay a poker debt. I graft and get it back.
Yeah, there's all families have got a few of those, haven't they? that's really cool. Just sort of before we start to wrap things up, you had a bit of an interesting experience at the Hay Festival a few years ago that I'm really interested in. Perhaps you could just tell us about that.
Yeah, so Hay-on-Wye is only about half an hour from me, and so I try each year and just go up and sit and listen to other people talk. I think it wasn't last year, it was the year before, they had quite a big focus on agriculture and food and farming and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I went up and listened to a bunch of different speakers, including people like Rosie Boycott. And I sat in this quite a big discussion where they were talking about a whole range of issues, but they were talking about people's move towards eating more plant-based food. And then there was a conversation about economics of food and whether food is too cheap, and what did that mean for people who couldn't afford food, and those sort of things, all the kind of things I'm actually really very interested in. Although I think it gets kind of debated in a really unhelpful way most of the time. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about essentially saying that food needed to still be cheap and because otherwise people couldn't afford food. And I felt the need to speak. They were doing a Q&A session, and so I stood up and I said I should probably, because there'd been a fair old kind of few comments about farmers, and they sort of talked a bit about farming like it was a theoretical thing. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, this is a really interesting take on, you know, 50 years ago half this room would have been farmers, and now we're a kind of a novelty act, it would feel sometimes. Mm-hmm. But there were people commenting from what I considered to be a position of not really knowing very much.
Yeah.
So I was talking about, I said, well, I should start by saying that I am one of the people that you've been talking about. I'm a small scale farmer, and I'm a meat farmer, meat producer. And I think that it's a horror show that people can't afford proper food in this country, but I don't think that's because food is too expensive. I think it's because the price of living is too high, and people are poor in this nation, and they shouldn't be. And the fact that they can't afford good food probably means they also can't afford electricity, and they can't afford their bills, and it's a poverty issue. It's not a food price issue, in my view. I kind of got on my soapbox a little bit and said farming isn't a theoretical thing, it's an actual thing. There are loads of us doing it, and there are people like me doing it small, and there are people doing it big, and the way that people farm is largely a product of the systems that have been created that push farmers to farm in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And you can try and pretend that you're not complicit in that, but if you ever walk into a supermarket, you are. Mm-hmm. If you ever buy one get one free, you are. Yeah. I am, we all are. Anyway, it I got a round of applause, and then afterwards I had a queue of people who wanted to talk to me. Still, I'd never really spoken to a farmer before. And I was stunned by that, because A, because people wanted to talk to farmers, but B, because they didn't really know any farmers and didn't know and had questions. And that really made me think quite a lot about, not a disconnect necessarily, but the way that society views farmers or doesn't really understand them at all, or doesn't understand why they do the things they do and why they farm the way they do, and why that might be a product of things that are bigger than farmers' decisions. So yeah, it properly kind of affected the way I thought about these things. And I see these food policy documents come out left, right and centre, and I long for a kind of a proper conversation that says there is no silver bullet to this. Mm-hmm. If you don't like the way that farmers farm things, buy differently,
yeah,
lobby differently, you know. But I think we've all got a part to play in trying to talk to people about what's real as opposed to what's reported and what's what becomes urban myths all over the place. And farmers, yeah, are neither good nor bad, you know. Farmers as a category, we're talked about as if we're all one thing, and we all know full well that's not the case. You'll have farmers that you think are brilliant and farmers that you wouldn't touch with a 10-foot barge pole, the same as in any profession, like all of us do, don't, yes, we?
So
it doesn't help you just to kind of categorize us all in one mass, I don't think.
No, I think it's really interesting. I suppose that's kind of why I started the podcast, really, and why I try not to make it too much of a technical farming podcast, because I wanted to get out of the bubble. And,
yeah,
you know, I've spoke to other guests about this, and I remember one of the early guests, Howell Davis, who's probably one of the most intelligent people I know, he summed it up very well by saying, be the farmer in the room. And, you know, because illustrating your point in that most people don't know many farmers. So, you know, if you're in a PTA meeting, if you're in something, you know, tell people you're a farmer, because they will be interested, yeah, in what you do. And perhaps in the past we've been quite reticent about that. We've almost been a bit embarrassed, yeah, in a way, because we've been viewed as these sort of simpletons. And but we've got, yeah, a lot to be proud of, haven't we?
And isn't that interesting? Because, and I said at a talk at the Abergavenny Food Festival, which I help run usually, I said it's the hardest thing I've ever done. I've done 20 years in the corporate game. I have never ever worked so hard physically, mentally, emotionally for such little capital return,
yeah,
but a return that is unquantifiable in other ways,
yeah,
and but it is so challenging. And the idea that somehow farming is an option for people who aren't clever enough to do anything else, sod off. I mean, seriously.
It's, yeah,
that I regularly stare at spreadsheets, my pig pregnancy planning spreadsheet, and go, why doesn't what's happening look anything like this spreadsheet? It's just like, it's a battle for intelligent people farming half the time, trying to,
yeah,
the order in which you have to do things, the dependency and the kind of crescendo of tasks,
yeah,
and those sort of things. It's a hugely kind of intelligent business, actually.
Yeah, well, we've just got to look out the window and look at the weather for a start, and the constant, yeah, curveballs, you know, you just can't plan, can you? So anyway, Martha, I've kept you long enough, so let's wrap up with the traditional hard-hitting questions, if you're ready for these.
they are hard,
much harder than you think. Even these, though, just going back to our previous point, these people might think these are a bit silly, but the idea is to show that, yes, farmers do have a favourite song. Yes, we do these things, and we have, you know, we're not these sort of caricatures.
We spend a lot of time in trucks.
Yeah, we do. I spend a lot of time with headphones in. Anyway, what's your all-time favourite song?
Yes, you see, the one is the difficult thing. I'd never be able to do Desert Island Discs ever. I'd be hopeless.
Yeah.
It would probably be Kirsty MacColl. And a track called In These Shoes, which is, okay, a very sassy tune.
Yeah, yeah.
And I am a great lover of shoes, even though I get to wear virtually nothing but wellies these days.
Yeah.
But it could equally be Springsteen, Glory Days. It could equally be Tom Petty, Into the Great Wide Open. Into the Great Wide Open actually has a line in it that says, Into the Great Wide Open, a rebel without a clue. And I remember standing on the hill in my field on my 40th birthday singing it because it was on the radio and going, yeah, that's just me.
That is one of my favorite tracks, and I'm also a massive,
is it really?
It is, and I'm also a massive Springsteen fan. But yeah, the much missed Kirsty MacColl, that's a great choice.
Oh yeah,
If you could know the absolute and total truth to one question, what would it be?
This was tough. This is tough. So, and it kind of, the thing that sprung to mind was actually a bit of a serious thing. So bear with. So I think the thing that I think a lot about, and actually it's quite evident on social media at the moment, is why, with all of the convenience and advances that technology and modern life has brought us, why it is that there are still so many very people who struggle so much with their mental health.
Yeah.
So what are we getting wrong in society that means that that's the case? Was it always this way and we just were too busy to acknowledge that was the case, or is it a modern, more modern phenomenon? And if so, what on earth's the answer, or what are the serious answers? Because that, I find that really troubling, just the sheer scale of mental health problems that seem to be evident now. And I would love to know what individuals can do to, and what society should be doing to help, really, I guess. I mean, I know, and it's a very simplistic thing and it's different for everyone, I'm sure, but I know that when I moved here, my mental health wasn't great for a variety of kind of life circumstance things. And I remember that my first year here, when I just had the three pigs and I had this rather beautiful vegetable garden, I remember sitting there on a Saturday night with no place particularly to go, but it was a sunny evening and the soil was warm, and I was sat on my backside weeding at about 8 o'clock at night, and it was a clear, warm, one of those beautiful summer nights. And I remember thinking for the first time, this I'm really happy here.
This is
where I want to be. And it was the first time I'd thought that in quite a long time, felt that kind of contented about life. And I do believe that outdoors and having your hands in the soil and doing things that are quite primeval in nature have some advantages. But I would love to know whether that's actually the case or not.
Yeah,
anyway, that was a bit serious, wasn't it? Sorry.
No, that's a really good answer, and sort of have similar realizations myself. We planted, and it may sound really silly, but we planted 300 meters of new hedge this year, and I've got so much out of just watching it. Well, doing the act itself, but also just seeing it grow. I mean, it's hundreds of butterflies, and it's just.
Yeah.
No, I'm a sort of pretty busy commercial farmer, but seeing that, I found genuinely heartwarming. And I think there's something in that. Really good answer. Mine would have been much shallower. I just want to know what really happened with the Kennedy assassination, but I'm obviously a lot more shallow. If you had 2 hours of completely free time, the pigs are all fed and happy, all your jobs are up to date, all your weeding's done, everything's, all the chores are done, what would you do?
I'd go for food. I'd go for lunch with Chris. My big love is food.
Yeah.
I love going out for food and someone else cooking it. And I love the sociability of going out for food. It's my favourite thing. The only reason I ever travel anywhere is food, basically. Yeah. When people say, I'll go on holiday for the beaches, no, I go for the food.
Me too. What would you call the title of your autobiography?
Difficult not to lapse into total cliche here, isn't it? I genuinely don't know, but I think it would involve the words mucky and middle-aged and Martha along the way. But I'm not sure how I would put all those things together without it sounding like something that you shouldn't Google on a work laptop.
I'll look out for that in a few years' time. And lastly then, what is your favourite agriculture-related social media account to follow and why?
There are some good ones, aren't there? Mm-hmm. So the first one I ever followed that became really significant with me was James Rebank's Herdy Shepherd one, which I think is probably a common thing. But the insight into his world and the fact that he didn't reveal himself to be who he was for a while and all of that sort of stuff, I was fascinated by his account. And I've subsequently chatted to him. Longbush Pork, who is a New Zealand
prolific
farmer. Utterly hilarious.
Yeah, definitely.
The mad exploits. Yeah. And I love how he was an accidental pig farmer as well. And then maybe Forage Fine Foods, which isn't an agricultural one, but she's a friend of mine, Liz Knight, who is a kind of hedgerow forager and makes these unbelievable well, fabulous drinks and food and things like that. And then I like hang fire as well. I know you asked me about hang fire before.
Oh yeah, I forgot to ask you about that. I've got the Hang Fire Barbecue Cookbook, and I'm a big fan of them in general. You have supplied them with pork, haven't you?
Yeah, so their TV, they've become great mates of mine, actually. I went to their restaurant. They were doing a soft launch, a relaunch of their restaurant last week, and we went. But Sam and Sean are brilliant. And, I mean, they, midlife crisis style, gave up their jobs in London.
Yes.
And started the pop-ups and launched the restaurant. But, yeah, their TV series, Sam and Sean's Cookout, the first one that was about Barry Town, the football club, they bought an entire pig off me, buried it in Barry Beach, and slow barbecued it.
I saw that one. That's really
I've never
cool.
been so nervous about watching a pig be brought out of the ground. It was fabulous. Their barbecue exploits are great fun too.
Martha, it's been great, lovely to speak to you. Brilliant to hear your story. Really inspiring, and keep up the good work.
Thanks, Will.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening. I hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.